Yeah, so what I wanted to do tonight was come at the Four Foundations in a way, a different kind of way, to see if it might be of some benefit. And so at the heart of our practice is this Four Foundations of Mindfulness. I'm gonna boost up the type size a little bit just to help myself out. Bear with me for a second, folks. So, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness in described by the Buddha in the Satipatthana Sutta, number 10 in the Majjhima Nikaya. How many people are familiar with the Four Foundations? Hands here. How about you all out there? Pretty good. Okay. So, if you get something from this that helps, that's sort of my idea. A lot of you are familiar, maybe a few aren't, but something that helps because it's not a huge sutta. It's like 15 pages, but it's so rich that when people teach about it, it tend to be long teaching going over many days. The books are huge and you can kind of get down on one part or another, but it's hard to see, like, how do you work with it moment by moment in practice? How can you make it fruitful? So that's what I wanted to kind of reframe it in a way that might be helpful for you. And do it in one session. So just for your reference, the four foundations are body vedanas, which is our experience of things being pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, mind tones or kind of states of mind, and then dhammas, which are sometimes translated as mind objects, but it's a whole bunch of discrete phenomena that arise in our minds, including thoughts and the aggregates and the hindrances and a whole bunch of stuff. And these four are of increasing subtlety if you look at it across from body to the end. I mean, body is, that's what we're aware of. We kind of live in bodies. Our animal friends live in their bodies and are aware of those. So that's kind of real basic, our us as human animals kind of stuff. And then the next three are all of mind, the Vedanas, mind states, and mind objects. And they get subtler because Vedanas is about contact with sense doors. Mind states is just sort of this underlying tones. And then the dhammas, it's just this whole complication, this proliferation that we intelligent human beings spin out. And sometimes I found with Dharma stuff, it's handy to go to the end and then work backwards. It can help us understand things in a different way. So that's kind of what I'm going to be doing in five steps, going from the result to the cause to help us understand. If we understand the result better, then we can understand what the causes are to get to the result. And at the end, and I'll do some reading, and this, by the way, is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And at the end of this Majjhima Nikaya, he made this big promise. It's like the only place in the entire Pali Canon where he promises anything like this. He promised enlightenment, and he says, if you practice for 7 years or 7 months or 7 weeks or 7 days or seven, it just gets pretty amazing that enlightenment could happen right away. And right at the end, he says, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 days, one or two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. This is a direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. So in particular, he said, this is the direct path for the realization of nibbana, for awakening. It's just a simple thing we're doing. It's pretty amazing. And the disappearance of pain and grief, some of the things we've been talking about. This very practice can take us to a place where we can navigate life no matter conditions with freedom. So there's this kind of sense of promise here. And you'd wonder, but that was 2,600 years ago, and the practice is alive and well, and people are waking up from it. And there are certainly great masters that we can read, even in the 20th century, and who have made astonishing attainments, something like Ajahn Mun or Ajahn Chah or Buddhadasa in Thai tradition, for instance. So what's the magic tool? Like, what gets us there? This is the next step back. Like, what is the tool that he described that makes this work? And in case we missed it in our readings, he points out the tool 13 times in the sutta, what's called the refrain. It's right in front of us, and you can kind of start to glaze over it. If you read the sutta over and over again over time, you can start to glaze over the refrain, like, oh, you again. But the reason why he said it 13 times is because he's offering us the key, like how this works. So I'm going to jump to the 13th of the refrain around mind objects. And he says, in this way, one abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects internally, or abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects externally, or one contemplates abiding mind objects as mind objects internally and externally. Or else one abides contemplating in mind objects their nature of arising, or one contemplates their nature of vanishing, or one abides contemplating the nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness that there are mind objects is simply established in one to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. I want to pick a few things out of there, because he says this 13 times through all the objects of mindfulness. And six of those are aspects of body, and five of them are aspects of dhammas, mind objects, and two of them, one is Vedanas and one is mind. So that's the 13. So essentially, the whole point is that he's covering everything. Like, any phenomena you could encounter is in there. So this practice isn't about breath meditation. It's about how we encounter phenomena and how we're mindful of them and how that's the path to awakening. So this message, not clinging to anything in the world, I mean, it sounds kind of simple in a way, but if you really start to look at it, like, practice, you know, meditate, contemplate it, what's he saying? Like, not clinging to anything in the world, because we kind of do, right? I mean, everyone here was talking about stuff they're struggling with clinging to, and that's what life brings us, is, you know, brings us right up against the places that it's hard to not cling. But that's where this practice takes us, in that total freedom. And then how the tool works, there's sort of code embedded in what he said. Because think about your own meditative practice. Most of us, there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, we have times of settledness and resting in the breath, but then thinking erupts in particular, and remembering and planning and all those kinds of things, and it comes and goes and comes and goes. And we think, oh, what a train wreck I am. I just keep thinking of all this stuff. And we kind of return to the breath. But that's actually what happens. And there's times of steadiness. But that's what happens, and that is, in fact, how the tool's working. And he's talking about there. He's completely acknowledging in what he says 13 times that rising and passing is just the way things are. Because he references that to all six mental things, all six physical things, and in particular all five mind objects, that they're going to arise and pass. And that arising and passing is something to be observed, just in that. He says, one abides contemplating in mind object their nature of arising. One abides contemplating in mind objects their nature of vanishing. So he's saying right there, that thing we do, that is the tool that brings us to not clinging. And this word vipassana, it could be translated as pure seeing, or clear seeing rather. Clear seeing. And that's what's happening when we're clearly observing the continuous nature of change. So even when our practice seems kind of muddled, you know, like, embrace it that way. It's like, yeah, I'm doing it. And just be aware of the muddle as it, you know, as it rises and passes. The stuff that comes and goes, just be aware of it, and that's it. That's it. And the breakthrough that we're referencing is we are seeing impermanence. We're seeing the impermanent nature of things. And it gets really refined. I mean, if you really start to look at thoughts appearing and disappearing and stop thinking that they're a problem and just be aware of them, it gets kind of startling because they come from absolutely nowhere. They kind of float and then they completely vanish and they're gone. And you couldn't bring back that thought if you wanted to. It's gone. And then it happens again and again and again and again. You know, it's crazy. So it's not crazy. It's just, it's how it is. So we kind of see there's nothing to depend on when we really see that everything's impermanent. And when we really can embrace that, that's where freedom lies. Because a lot of our stuckness is wanting things to not be impermanent, looking for some kind of permanence to rest ourselves on. But really, the Buddha's calling us to rest in that freedom of change, because that's just how it is. He didn't make it up. It's just how it is. So the tool, the way it works is, in the Four Foundations, is we're realizing impermanence precisely by watching the arising and passing of all four of those. All four foundations, the 13 repetitions of the refrain, they're all saying the same thing. Saying about body, saying about positions of body, saying about the Vedanas, the rising and passing. So just paying attention to that, and that's taking us into realizing impermanence. So he says it over and over again in case we don't get it, because it's kind of hard to get. But it's striking that he said it 13 times. He doesn't do that kind of thing so much in the suttas, so it's really worth paying attention to that fact, that that's how he structured this incredibly important sutta. And he says, you know, one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. I mean, that's so amazing. You know, you think of, I mean, often, this, I'm sorry, this is probably one of my lines, but you think of the Dalai Lama, you know, the stuff that we get stuck on, all of our interpersonal stuff, and am I cool, and, or not even that, but just the ways we defend ourselves and feel hurt and vulnerable and have hot buttons. Dalai Lama doesn't. As far as I can see from everything I've ever seen over many, many years, you couldn't insult him because he would just have compassion. He wouldn't land anywhere because he's so awakened, you know? So he's not clinging to anything in the world, not to mention he doesn't care about stuff or fast cars or trips to the Bahamas or whatever people care about. So that's kind of the core tool or instruction of this sutta, is how mindfulness brings insight because we see directly the impermanence of things. And then once we start to see that everything's impermanent and we're looking internally, we're looking at, because one of the five lists that is the Dhammas is the aggregates, the five aggregates that make up our sense of self. So when we're looking at all those things arising and passing, these five that make up our sense of self, it starts to take apart our sense of me. And that's sort of a second way that brings us to awakening, the way the tool works. And this is, you know, not self, anicca. And from these two, we start to realize, you know, we get past dukkha, because dukkha happens when we're trying to not have those two be, not recognize those two. But when we really can fully embrace the fact that things change and there's no self, then suffering doesn't happen, because suffering happens in reference to attachment to those two points of view. So that's how the tool works, but how do we actually do this? And there's actually, because it's hard, right? We've been practicing for years, many of us, and it's like, it's hard, and, you know, we'd like to be awakened, but we feel like we're just regular schmooze muddling along sometimes. But it's really worth looking at the suttas, because he tells you what to do in a more precise way than we might realize. And this is part of why kind of going backwards is helpful, because we see the vision, we see the tool. Okay, how do I do the tool? And it's right at the very beginning of the sutta. He says some really extraordinary things that kind of get missed sometimes, because we start talking about the foundations and miss how he sets it up before he even starts. So that's the third, I said to do five things. This is the third one, kind of aspect of the practice. And it's two parts, you could say. And you could say the first one's kind of cultivating. The first one's the attitude, and the second one is kind of the physical setup of how to practice. This is just my own sort of language, I'll admit. But see if this works, because the attitude right at the beginning, it gives us a sense of how to approach this endeavor. And in one short sentence, he touches on four key points, and then he repeats these in this little nifty little paragraph. He goes through the same cycle for each of the four foundations. So he goes through this, he repeats these four points. And what's kind of cool, amazing, is that since he said this 2,600 years ago to a bunch of male monastics, that here in the 21st century, this little list really works. I mean, it just lands right where we are. It's one of the extraordinary things about the Buddha's teachings is it never seems dated. So I'm going to read this, and I'm going to take the liberty of changing the word bhikkhus to people and the he's to she. So we'll just kind of get some equity here. So the sutta says, she abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. That's what it says about how to practice mind objects as mind objects. Let's break it out a bit. First, contemplating mind objects as mind objects. I mean, that's really interesting because, you know, most of the mind objects that come at us are our thoughts, a lot of the time. And those could be, but they also could be hindrances. They could be through the sense doors. All that stuff's in the array of the fourth foundation. But the point here is we just cultivate mindfulness of them, whatever they are. Or same with the body parts. We just cultivate mindfulness just as they are. We don't try to figure them out, you know, understand them, plan how they're going to work better, anything. Just mindfulness. That's the thing that works. And then he says that ardent is this great word, ardent, which in Pali, it's atapi, which is a pretty clean, from what I understand from, I do not speak Pali, but I pick up a lot of words. It's a pretty clean, close translation to ardent, a sense of strong energy, strong application to really be ardent about this. The dictionary talks about eager, zealous application of energy. And that's what the Buddha is suggesting. You know, we're not coasting here. We got to lean into it when we're practicing, because it's kind of a life and death matter. And you would think, in that case, that vibrant energy would be worthwhile. And then fully aware. That's a really interesting word. I'm sampajana, or sampajano in Pali. It's often translated as clear comprehension. So it's kind of like it partners with mindfulness, because mindfulness, we see things arise and pass, and then clear comprehension understands what we saw. So we really have to pay attention in that way. It's not like mindless mindfulness, but we're looking and we see. We recognize with clear comprehension. So we're ardent, we're doing ardence, we're being ardent about it. We're bringing clear comprehension to it. And then mindfulness, you know, being aware moment by moment, what's arising and passing, we probably know what that is pretty much. But the last one, having put away covetousness, different translations on that one, and grief for the world. That's really interesting, because it has this, you know, there's a lot of aspects of the Dharma where you're cultivating a understanding that will then self-reveal later. So it's a little bit of fake it till you make it. But so you come into the practice with this sense of putting away covetousness and grief for the world, for what happened to you, for your memories, for the things you want, all that stuff, as much as you can in terms of the practice. And then that's going to be part of the not clinging. It emerges naturally later from insight, but it's part of the exercise to make this practice work. You know, that's what we say when you come in, let go of what you were doing, let go of what you're planning, try to be in the present. All of those different emphases is kind of around that whole area. And all the stuff about really starting to look clearly at past and present, you know, and how past is actually just memories. There's no actual past, and future is planning, basically. There's no actual future. We're here. But to really get that, that's actually kind of extraordinary. So right at the beginning, the Buddha is setting it up. You know, be ardent. Be clearly comprehending. Don't wallow in stuff. Just to get the practice to move. And then the second part, this sort of setup or kind of how to do it. It's really interesting how tactile it is. The Buddha said, here a person, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded her legs crosswise, sets her body erect and established mindfulness in front of her, ever mindful, she breathes in, mindful, she breathes out. Simple as that. A person goes to the forest, root of a tree, or an empty hut, or, you know, the corner of one of your bedrooms. It's kind of the same thing. You go to this place where there's nothing going on other than an opportunity to practice and sit cross-legged if you can or not, you know, sit in a chair if you have to, whatever. But spine upright, establish mindfulness, and breathe in and out. Simple as that, but it's real clear. It's like really concise, clear. This is what you do. And he often says, you know, it pops up again and again in the suttas. He'll say, bhikkhus, there are huts, there are trees. Go practice, lest you regret it later. So he's saying the same thing in a kind of a different form here, but he's just saying, here's what you got to do, guys and gals, is sit down, sit up straight, and do it. And here's that little sentence, do it with ardency. So, you know, so we've kind of talked about the goal of awakening, the tool of how this mindfulness works, the kind of the setup of how to actually do it, kind of offering that. And then this, to me, the beauty of all this, which he offered in the sutta, is then it starts to clarify our relationship with the four foundations of mindfulness and our practice itself. When we really got a good sense of where we're going, how this works, and how to do it, just the practical things of what the Buddha said about how to do it, you know, just check it out. But then we can start to work with these four foundations in a different kind of way, because then it sort of makes more sense. We're kind of under the hood, understanding better what it is we're about in the first place. Why are we even doing this? Where is it going to take us if we do it well? And I couldn't find the quote, but there's this beautiful quote in the sutta somewhere where the Ananda, his attendant, kind of goes in this, they have these wonderful little, like, not exactly intimate, but these close little conversations. Ananda was his cousin, a very sweet and gentle man. And he'll say these really sort of, I don't know, like familiar things. Like if you hang out with the Buddha for 20 years, I guess you get kind of familiar. So there's these amazing little conversations. And in one of them, he goes in this kind of role, Ananda does, naming all the psychic powers and the amazing powers that the Buddha supposedly has. He can walk through stone. He can fly distances. He can read people's minds. And he says, oh, these are all amazing powers you have. And Ananda says, and the Buddha says, well, Ananda, the actual amazing power a Buddha has is to be mindful, to be completely aware of exactly what he's doing moment by moment, whether it's inside or outside. That's the amazing power a Buddha has. To really completely be present and see it. It's really cool, and I wish I could have found it, but I didn't. But anyway, that's the point. And that's what this is getting at, the sutta. Because when you really kind of get all this stuff, and then you look at it, truly, it's looking at everything. You know, nothing is omitted. If you can find any aspect of your phenomenal experience that isn't in here, you know, show me. Because it's all there, and the whole point is be mindful of all of it. And when we start to understand that, then it's like, oh, okay, that got real simple. And yeah, we're doing mindfulness practice, I mean, hopefully, on some regular basis on our cushions, but then the whole rest of the time. You know, what about if our spouse is saying incredibly unfair stuff to us? I suspect that happens occasionally to people. Or what about if, you know, your job's blowing up on deadline or your jaw's blowing up because some, you know, not so delicate dentist is there or whatever. But right there, that's the moment to be mindful because it's what's happening. But you can kind of hold it differently if you can track back where it's going to go and the power of this. You know, this is my moment right now. Wish it wasn't so darn uncomfortable, but it is my moment right now to cultivate mindfulness. And clearly people who do, you can see the strength that they develop. Cause, you know, if we walk around sort of everything's okay now, but if it somehow goes a little south, then I'm in trouble. Well, how about if we get past that? So if it goes a little south, we're still okay. And I'll humbly say, you know, I'm aware of my comfortable upper middle class existence that I have those fears too. But nonetheless, that is the deal. And how we navigate that. You know, my wife and I just went through, so some of you know, we had this sort of cancer party. She and Kathy were talking, which is really sweet. And my wife had a bladder cancer, some of you know, and just discovered it by accident because she was in the ER for something else. And they took a CT scan. And the ER doc said, you know what? You got a mass there. And so they ended up taking it out but the oncologist said, we're good, going back in 3 months, but no problem. But during that period of not knowing, you know, we were like, okay, this might be it, you know, and we were really just kind of breathing with it and staying present with it and seeing what we could see, how we could be not clinging in the middle of maybe the end or not, or pain coming, or, you know, and clearly we're going to get sick, old age, and die. Not forgetting about that. So the point of this whole sutta is to be mindful of everything, and insight arises from those moments of mindfulness. And it makes it really helpful to bring it into the world when you really have that down in your bones. That there's no off time. You know, if you go to Home Depot or something, right there, be mindful right there when you pick up the 2x4, when you walk through the checkout line or whatever. Just that moment. And we trick ourselves. It's hard, you know? And we try to be mindful when we're in pain. But then if something really fun is happening, we're not trying to be mindful. We're like into it. You know, right? That's the whole power of distractions. This is an embarrassing moment, but I sometimes share. I used to work downtown near Pioneer Square, and there was an emporium called the Lusty Lady, which had strippers and stuff, but they were known for their incredible marquees. And during the Gulf War, they had a big sign that said, weapons of mass distraction. And I always thought that was like a great Dharma statement, like weapons of mass distraction. You know, that's what our culture brings to us. And so we got to be mindful there. Also, and that's, but when we understand how this works better, then it helps us remember, oh yeah, got to do it right there. And so in terms of practice, I would suggest that you can think of the four foundations as kind of like, I don't know, I visualize like kind of like a scaffolding, like this structure that you can see all these different aspects to be mindful of. And if I get spaced out, I go, oh, what's happening now? Is it physical? Maybe it's Vedanas. Maybe it's my mind state. What's up? Maybe I'm feeling gloomy. Okay, that's mind state. Maybe I'm really wishing or I'm not liking. That's Vedanas. Let me just finish this sentence and then I'll... So to be aware of the four foundations and the depth of them and bring those into your practice. And when, you know, because sometimes in practice we can get a little bit sort of directionless. We sort of forget why we're doing it. We just kind of space out a little bit. It's hard to catch where we're going with it, but this can really help. It can really bring us to what we're doing. Yeah, so I guess I'm saying to be flexible with these four foundations and the 13 aspects, the 13 refrains, and let yourself, you know, slide back and forth, so to speak. You know, if something's coming at you, if it becomes a predominant object versus primary object, then go with it. But if you can really sort of internalize how this thing is structured, it can be a really fruitful way to navigate practice. I'm just going to finish up here before any more questions or thoughts. Yeah. And to keep the goal in mind. You know, that is what the Buddha taught. I mean, he's incessantly talking about Nibbana. And even, you know, that may seem way big and far away, but there's tastes of it. There's hints of it for any of us. You know, times of freedom, times when we're aware of some phenomena and then we're not so sticky in it. That's like a hint. It's a hint. So these are really powerful, powerful things, well worth cultivating. Let's just sit for a minute.